I am a spy, a sleeper, a spook, a man of two faces and two minds. With these haunting words, we enter the consciousness of a nameless narrator whose very existence embodies the contradictions of the Vietnam War. Half French, half Vietnamese, he serves as aide to a South Vietnamese general while secretly reporting to communist handlers. This duality isn't just professional, it's woven into his DNA, making him simultaneously insider and outsider in every world he inhabits. Called Bastard throughout his life, he possesses a unique curse, the ability to see every issue from both sides, to understand complexities that others, in their certainty, miss entirely. This divided consciousness becomes both his greatest strength and his deepest wound. What does it mean to live between worlds? For our narrator, it means mastering the art of belonging nowhere while appearing to belong everywhere. He speaks perfect French and Vietnamese, moves effortlessly between colonial and native societies, and understands both Western and Eastern philosophies. Yet beneath this chameleon-like adaptability lies a profound identity crisis. When his American University Department chair asks him to chart his personality between Orient and Occident traits, the academic exercise merely formalizes what he's always known. He exists in the hyphen between identities, the space between belonging. Saigon collapses in chaos, ammunition depots exploding, the president fleeing with gold-laden suitcases, civilians clawing at embassy gates. Americans abandon their allies, offering a single evacuation plane when many more are needed. They started this war, the general laments, and now that they're tired of it, they've sold us out. On evacuation night, our narrator checks the manifest while blue armored buses wait. The general weeps as he apologizes to his butler. His wife gives dollars to staff before their convoy heads to the airport, now a scene of desperate chaos. The escape turns tragic when communist forces reach the perimeter. A bullet strikes Bond's wife and child. Our narrator punches Bond to break his grip on his wife's body, carries her, and runs for the departing aircraft with Bond following, carrying their son. They barely make it aboard as the plane corkscrews upward. In that moment, they become refugees, people defined not by who they are, but by what they've lost. What happens when you transplant a people from one soil to another? In America, Vietnamese refugees face government policies of strategic dispersal, preventing cultural enclaves, and forcing rapid assimilation that breeds isolation. Our narrator studies his culture through a Western lens, while his friend Bon numbs grief with welfare checks and beer, his combat skills now worthless. We soaked ourselves in sadness, and we rinsed ourselves with hope, the narrator writes. Almost all of us refused to believe that our nation was dead. This denial serves as both protection and wound. Their community recreates fragments of former lives through precise coffee preparation, authentic street food, and sunset guitar sessions. The general's liquor store symbolizes diminished circumstances. Yet beneath this humble facade, he maintains his warrior spirit, training a secret army of former soldiers, now busboys and laborers, in the hills outside Los Angeles. These men escape in weekend warrior routines, standing proudly in old uniforms instead of assuming the refugee slump, that forward bend of people carrying invisible burdens. When recruited as a cultural consultant for a Vietnam War film, our narrator discovers his role is merely ceremonial in an industry where they owned both the means of production and representation, leaving us natives hoping for a word in edgewise before our anonymous deaths. His suggestions face constant resistance. Vietnamese extras remain backgrounded with minimal dialogue, cultural nuances get simplified for cinematic appeal, and the film serves as a local anesthetic preparing the American mind for future violence. The screening devastates Bon. "You were going to make sure we came off well, but we weren't even human." When the narrator points to the Vietnamese rolls he secured, Bond counters, "All you did was give them an excuse. Now white people can say, 'Look, we got yellow people in here.'" The narrator's contribution remains uncredited. At dinner with American intellectuals, when Dr. Head claims life is not important to Orientals, our narrator cleverly distinguishes that life is valuable to his people, but invaluable to Westerners, exposing Western misunderstandings of Asian experiences. In a re-education camp, our narrator confronts how his revolution has become as oppressive as the regime it overthrew. The commandant practices doublespeak, praising humane rehabilitation while ignoring the countryside devastated by American defoliants. This propaganda conceals systematic dehumanization, forced confessions, sleep deprivation, and psychological torture cynically called re-education. The most devastating moment occurs when the narrator reunites with his blood brother Man, now camp commissar with a napalm-scarred face, who admits, "Now that we are powerful, we don't need the French or Americans to fuck us over. We can fuck ourselves just fine." This exemplifies the tragic pattern where revolutionary movements pursuing justice devolve into authoritarian control, with former freedom fighters employing the same surveillance, intimidation, and ideological conformity they once fought against. During re-education, the commissar repeatedly asks, "What is more precious than independence and freedom?" After offering various rejected answers, our narrator discovers through torture the answer, nothing. This becomes the novel's philosophical center. The communist slogan contains a subversive truth. Nothing itself, the void, absence, is more precious than abstract ideals used to justify suffering. All ideologies ultimately rest on nothing. This realization brings enlightenment reminiscent of Buddhism's emptiness concept. The narrator's sobbing transforms to laughter as he grasps existence's cosmic joke. Nothing evolves from simple negative to profound truth. Rather than despair, this nihilistic insight offers liberation. Having seen through grand narrative's illusion, the narrator embraces life's meaninglessness. As he and companions prepare to flee as boat people, risking death while carrying their manuscript, they promise, "We will live," choosing life not for grand purpose, but precisely because nothing justifies it. In the re-education camp, our narrator writes his confession, the novel itself, during isolated sessions. The commandant demands communist simplicity over his bourgeois intellectual style. Through this tension, storytelling becomes both shield and sword. Each word preserves his sanity while projecting compliance, balancing truth with acceptable fiction. During escape planning, the prisoners protect these pages in watertight plastic, valuing them as much as weapons and supplies. The novel serves as meta-commentary on how narratives shape memory and history, with power partly dependent on controlling which stories circulate. The narrator's divided loyalties allow him to deconstruct oversimplified Vietnam War narratives. Storytelling's power culminates in the blood brotherhood between the narrator, Man, and Bon. Despite fighting for opposing sides, their connection through shared stories transcends political ideology. As the narrator leaves Vietnam again, he thinks of his blood brother dreaming his morphine dream, capturing both connection and division. Perhaps the greatest courage lies in refusing the false comfort of certainty, remaining perpetually questioning and human.